This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. 20 years ago, Regina Spektor, who was born in Moscow, was just another aspiring musician in New York. She was lugging around a backpack full of self-produced CDs and playing at little clubs in the East Village, anywhere that had a piano, really. But anonymity in Spektor's case, it didn't last long. She toured with the Strokes in 2003, and once she had a record deal of her own, her ambitions grew well beyond the borders of indie music.
I never loved nobody fully. Always one foot on the ground.
Her album Begin to Hope went gold, and Spektor began moving into more of a pop vein, writing anthems about love and heartbreak, loneliness and death and God. And she even wrote the theme song to Orange is the New Black.
Today is new, and everyone is waiting, waiting on you, and you got time.
Spektor's songs are powered by years of classical training on the piano, and a voice that often goes from a whisper to a roar in just a flash. Her new record is called Home Before and After. And to mark the occasion, the New Yorker's music critic Amanda Petrasich joined Regina Spektor in a living room with a grand piano to hear some of the new songs.
So, Regina, it's been quite a while since we've had a record from you. Who's counting? But 2016 was the last time, and it feels like since that moment, the world has kind of turned itself inside out a few times. I'm curious how the last 6 years have been for you. And I know there's been some performances and a residency and some kind of one-off recordings, but how have you been spending that time?
Well, you know, it's one of those things where as I've been doing some interviews with this record coming out, that's how I found out how much time has passed. I'm not really aware of time in a kind of useful way. So I think I have a serious time management problem. And I think that a lot of the time when the world is normal and when there's structure, I sort of rely on that to kind of push me along, like that famous line of like, there's nothing more inspiring than a deadline. And for me, that's very, very true. So what I do is I end up writing songs just as I live life. Like they're kind of like a byproduct of me in the world. But also I guess every dream has its, you know, its shadow side. And my shadow side is that I will stretch time unless somebody tells me that I have to do something.
Is that isolation kind of typically an essential part of your process? That sort of old jazz idea of woodshedding of, you know, I just have to go away for a while and kind of live with this work and be in it and be free of distractions for a moment to sort of focus and make art that speaks to me.
Well, it's funny. I never get to go away and sort of do that thing for writing. Like, I always hear about people. They're like, I went to a cabin and I wrote a record. I'm like, how? How did you? You know, because to me, it's like a lot of the time, I have friends. They actually know how to, you know, every day at this time, they will go and they'll work. You know, I'm not like that. I have to feel inspired. And I could almost when I talk about it in an interview, I can almost like hear eyes rolling. Like, I can almost like feel it. And it's like this horrible thing where, I don't know, I must have put this idea into my head. Like, I remember reading some interview in some music magazine on an airplane like years ago, and it just somehow like it kind of wounded me like a little paper cut where it was some, I don't even remember who the musician was, but I remember it was a man, and he was kind of an, you know, legendary, and he was saying that, you know, I'm just so sick and tired of people talking about inspiration, like music writing is craft and it's hard work. And I was sort of like, I don't know what he's talking about. I have never experienced that, you know? And it's just like, I know hard work in the studio. I know long hours. I know throwing yourself into deadlines. I know hard work of practicing for hours and relearning all these songs that I basically forget fully from time to time. But I only can write when I'm inspired. And I only, you know, if I sit down to the instrument and I start to play and it just feels like nothing. It almost disgusts me on a physical level to like continue. I step away, I do something else. I'll cook, I'll take a walk, I'll do all of the things on my endless to-do list. But I can't force myself to try and write a song.
You know, I am not a famous old man, but I thought the way that you were describing songwriting was so beautiful and lovely. And it's, you know, it's organic and it's kind of a part of your life and you haven't compartmentalized it or professionalized it in a way that makes it sort of an island, you know, in the stream of your existence. It's really, it's like breathing. And I think in some ways I would imagine that leaves you really open to sort of the whims of the day. You know, it's anything can kind of blow through the window in that moment.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And that's beautiful. Yeah, I love that image. I do feel like there's some part of me that's like, well, this is just how you make art. And everybody's got these different systems. There's almost 8 billion of us on this planet, and we really vary. And so it's like, maybe my type of system is just kind of needed for this kind of music. And then there's all this other music in the world that, I mean, that's sort of the blessing, like how diverse we are. It's just, I mean, we pay so many terrible prices for being humans. Yeah. One of the good things is let's enjoy the good stuff.
Yeah, no, I love that idea. Could we, Regina, hear a bit of Loveology?
Oh yeah, sure. Humanist you are. Oh, an incurable humanist you are.
Song about nothing at all.
Sit down, class. Open up your textbooks to page 42.
So speaking of time, Regina, there's a line in Up the Mountain, a new song, or two lines, actually, that I think about a lot in my own life. You ask us to hurry, hurry, but also slow down, slow down. And I feel like, God, is there anything else that sort of better encapsulates, you know, the tension of life in the 21st century? I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that song, about the mountain in that song, and maybe play us a tiny bit.
Well, you know, when I started writing this song, I didn't even realize that I was writing it at first. I kind of just got that little, you know, the little, like yes. This little rhythm in me. And I would just walk and I was always hearing, it was like a tiny haunting. I would like be at a stoplight. I would just be like this little, and I would just be like wiggling like a crazy person, like to that little rhythm.
Fine. It's a little sinister. Like I like that just tiny bit of eeriness to that bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was just kind of like always tapping me on the shoulder, you know, and I would just be at home and it would be doing it and I would just be, and it was just around me. Whenever it would get quiet, it would just kind of sneak in and just be there. And then one day, I started kind of pulling on this thread of it, and it really, and then that little, you know, that little, like, in the ocean, there's a mountain. On the mountain, there's a forest. In the forest, there's a garden. 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 Gotta get in there, gotta get in there, gotta get in there, gotta get in there. And it was just this kind of fairy tale started to kind of emerge, almost like, you know, those old fairy tales that have like a, I know that some of the Russian ones would have this, but where you would have a sort of this ball of yarn and it would just roll and you would just follow the thread and you would pull on the thread. And it was kind of like this very mysterious little fairy tale emerged.
Yes. Your music is so sophisticated. It's so gorgeous, but there is this sense of wonder that's almost childlike, right? There's a imagination that's kind of clearly fueling this work in a way that seems extraordinary to me and so singular to you and your work. And it, there's almost almost kind of a fairy tale quality to some of the narratives. And it's interesting to hear you talk about how those things are linked.
Yeah, I mean, I am very, very happy sort of when I'm not necessarily in the mucky muck of the logistics of the world. I'm very happy to be like in the world of the like unconscious and the symbolic and the archetypal, you know, and all that. Or I'm really, really happy sort of just being like, wee, you know, in the like whimsical and the surreal and the kind of, I think that, you know, life pushes you, especially as an adult, and especially when you're responsible for other little humans, to be a present in this kind of logistics sort of way. And I think that I try as much as possible to just integrate fun, because I love fun, and I love beauty, and I love magic, and this world is really full of that. And I will not have anybody take that away. I'm very much like, I fight for certain things, and that's one of the things I fight for. It's like I protect the borders of my land from like the invasion of the unfun and the dreary and the dull and the boring and the, you know.
And it's so, such an important idea, right? Because I think the culture of the world, you're saying as adults, it tries to teach us that playfulness and seriousness are somehow at odds, that that's a binary. Yes. Those things can't exist at the same time. You know, certainly I think your music proves otherwise, but it is a practice to sort of say like, no, this can be joyful and light and buoyant and silly and also be, you know, a serious composition. It can also be a real piece of music.
Yeah, and you know what? One of the things that I truly, truly, I guess I'm like holding a torch for is like the idea that fiction can be really, really true and emotionally true. I think, at least at the moment, it seems that for the most part in our culture, in our society, the consensus is that, you know, things that are autobiographical or biographical are true.
Right.
And it's sort of all interchangeable. And I'm just kind of out there holding a torch for, like, you know, like Gregor Samsa and like Anna Karenina. They're as real to me, you know, as real people. And they're as personal, they're as authentic. And I think in the world of art, you know, I pledge allegiance to the imagination. And in writing songs that oftentimes end up in the realm of stories or fairy tales, or maybe have the I or the me be something other than Regina, you know, I strive for that, but I truly believe in that. Why can't you be very serious about being playful?
Yeah.
You know, why can't you be really personal about fiction?
There's also a song on the record called Becoming All Alone. And for me, I think the most sort of stark and intense quality of, you know, these last couple of years is, you know, the isolation and kind of alienation. And I'd love for you to play us a little bit.
Sure. I went walking home alone, past all the bars and corner delis, when I heard God call out my name. And he said, hey, let's grab a beer, it's awful late, we both right here. And we didn't even have to pay, 'cause God is God and he's revered. And I said, why isn't it get better? Becoming all alone again. Stay, stay, stay. Let the ones who want it bad get all the things that make them better. Let the ones who don't care feel.
Becoming all alone.
Regina Spektor at the piano playing Becoming All Alone.
Why is music so fucking hard to play?
That's from Spektor's new album, Home, Before and After. She's talking with staff writer Amanda Petrusich. We'll continue in just a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland had promised the findings of the House Select Committee on January 6th would blow the roof off the House. On our podcast, Politics and More, three of the New Yorker's best political minds, Susan Glasser, Jane Mayer, and Evan Osnos, will talk about what the committee has revealed and what impact it may have on America. That's the new episode of Politics and More from the New Yorker. Our music writer, Amanda Petrusich, spoke recently with Regina Spektor, the singer and pianist and songwriter, and we'll return to that conversation now. Spektor came to this country as a child from Russia, and that experience as an immigrant from Europe was really formative for her. So Amanda asked her about the war in Ukraine and this moment of dangerous tension between the United States and Russia.
Regina, you were born in Moscow and lived there until you were 9 years old. Curious, you know, lately Russia obviously has been occupying the national imagination as we saw kind of look on as this conflict with Ukraine continues. I just wanted to ask you about your perspective on that war from afar.
Well, I mean, I think in some ways my view into it is probably it's just colored by all of these different layers of everything I've experienced. Like, in some ways, I'm just like every other single, like, sane person on the planet looking at a war that's begun in this day and age with these weapons on an absolutely, you know, on civilians, on a country, like an unnecessary war. In another way, just having come from the Soviet Union, where really all of those republics and all of those kind of countries were united. Granted, they were united through absolute like repression and oppression. But, you know, when I was little, like we had all, half of my family are like from Ukraine and half are from Russia. They're all over the place. My grandparents grew up right. If they're from Zhytomyr, my dad's parents, and my other grandparents are from Belarus, and my great uncle is from Siberia, from Novosibirsk, and I have all these relatives from Siberia, and then I have all these relatives from Odessa, and then I have all these friends from Kharkov, and now it's St. Petersburg, but Leningrad, and all these other places. And so to me, it was just like, We all had the same music. We all had the same films. We all had the same food. Everybody fought the Nazis, you know. And so to me, the only, I guess, little bit of without speaking out of both sides of my mouth and with complete acknowledgement of the horror and the nightmare of it, and that there's obviously a wrong party and a right party, it's the only thing that that rises up in me is this vilification of the humans, the Russian people.
Right.
I do not believe that this is people. I do not believe that, I don't believe in cultural bans, but I think if you have it in you, if you have the soul strength to not dehumanize the Russian people and to not start creating another boogeyman and saying, well, the Russians this and the Russians that, then you will be part of the solution to this. Because the more we vilify and isolate and sort of bad dog, when you start to take away a nation's dignity, when you start to make them feel like they are, they don't have a seat at the table as people, you are literally working in partnership with those leaders, because propaganda works. That's why they all do it. And I think that you're basically helping. You're helping the people just be corralled, be walked right into the prison of, well, they don't respect you. They don't understand you. They hate you. I love you. I will help you. I'll take care of you. And I think that the more we can connect culture, the more we can keep people realizing that it's the same feelings, the same songs, the same films, that same art, that we value these things together, that we, like, it's not like somebody in St. Petersburg is sitting there not worrying about their child, you know, right, or wanting to hurt somebody.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And that's the thing. It's like, I don't want to carpet bomb any city.
Yeah.
But somebody could be doing that in my name right now.
Of course. I mean, and I think you're right, too, that music and art can be such a clarifying and powerful force in terms of kind of reminding us of our own humanity and our sort of shared experience of this earth. And I'm curious if that has been an experience for you sort of touring and performing globally. You know, these stories you're telling feel very singular and kind of unique to you, but here they are resonating so broadly.
Yeah, I mean, I think I have gotten just the privilege of it hasn't worn off at all. But I definitely remember just when I first began touring the world, just being shocked, even just that people would know the songs, that they would connect with them, and even just with the idea that these weren't English-first language countries. But also, I really would feel it. I have this one song called "Après Moi," and it has a stanza from Boris Pasternak in it of a poem, and I sing it in Russian, and it's the way that the audiences all over the world would connect to me speaking Russian, like to them, or singing Russian rather. It was just so beautiful because it almost felt like, with them not being English as their first language audiences, and with me not being an English as my first language a performer, that we would meet in sort of this whole other place that was like beyond sort of national kind of boundaries, and that we could all just be really together. And yeah, it's really like there are no boundaries, no language barriers. We're all just here together. We're all blown about. And one day you can be in another country than your own, and you will connect with people and bring something of your culture there.
It's such an important and comforting idea. Could you play a bit of that song, or are you not ready for that at all? It's okay if you can't.
Let me see.
Figured I'd ask.
Mm.
take that which isn't yours. I must go on standing. I'm not my own. It's not my choice. La da da, la da da. Be afraid of the lame. They'll inherit your legs. Be afraid of the old.
Regina Spektor. That was Après Moi, released in 2006. Her new album is Home Before and After, and she spoke with The New Yorker's Amanda Petrusich. Now, if you didn't get enough, we've got even more music from Regina Spektor on our podcast episode. It's a kind of epic song called Spacetime Fairy Tale, and really beautiful. You can hear that on the podcast of The New Yorker Radio Hour. There's also more to come today, so stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. All over the country this week, from Connecticut to Florida to Washington, qualifying races are being held for a competition in a sport that you may not have heard a lot about, drone racing. The qualifiers continue through mid-July for the Multi-GP Championship later this year. So drone racing, what exactly is drone racing? Let's be clear, these aren't the drones you can buy your kid on Amazon, nor are they the military drones you may have read about that are flying over Ukraine. Racing drones are a specialty item, custom built for that purpose alone. At least one drone was clocked at 180 miles an hour. I first heard about all this from staff writer Ian Frazier, who reported for us on drone racing in the sport's early days, starting at an event billed as the Drone National Championships in 2016.
Multi-rotor racing, the 2016 U.S. Drone Nationals. Thank you to all of our local corporate and national partners who we'll get to you in just a little bit as we make history.
It was one of those things that happened early on in the development of a sport, I guess, in that it was not really very well thought out.
Pilots, goggles down. Arm your copters. We are on the tone in less than five.
You couldn't really tell who was in first and who was in second because drones are small and drones can go really fast. 80 miles an hour is a kind of regular speed. When maneuvering gets complicated, they may go down to 60 miles an hour. It was hard to follow, but in the course of it, there were two pilots who I knew about. A noob is Zachary Thayer. That was his racing name. And Jet is Jordan Temkin. Zach won both the race and also the freestyle competition. So he came away with $12,000. I did follow them starting at that point because they were really exciting and really good racers. And then I found out that they shared a house out in Fort Collins, Colorado. And they were also, there was a third drone guy named Travis, so I went out and visited them.
Jordan.
And I have Travis.
How's it going?
All right.
Yeah, welcome.
I am Travis McIntyre.
And I'm Zachary Thayer. So yeah, we live just outside of Fort Collins on a little 1-acre property. It's pretty much just a house that us three live in, and all we do is drone things.
Has sweet lacy curtains too.
Mm-hmm. They're not really our style, but...
No, they're our style now, man.
Jordan and Zach are both 26. Travis is 31. He does not race competitively very often, although he does sometimes. And this is just a, you know, I think maybe 2-3-bedroom ranch house in a suburban development. They moved there, they said, in order to become better drone pilots. And they succeeded, which is kind of great.
But yeah, first thing that you pretty much see when you walk in the door is this giant wall of trophies.
Yeah, California, Arizona, Dubai, New York. Man, lots of places.
Yeah.
Well, they do travel a lot, and these trophies are from all these different places where they've raced and placed.
And then there's more drones in the kitchen.
Oh, yeah.
And more drone chargers and...
laptops and more controllers and more batteries. Yeah.
And there's the basement, and the basement is, it was a workshop.
So our drone basement is a bit of chaos.
But,
oh man, this is just amazing.
You got a little video.
This is really incredible. This is like a drone fleet. This is just. Yeah.
This is mostly stuff that doesn't really ever fly anymore. So these are like relative.
Still fly anymore?
No. So these work. We just never fly them.
We went through a lot of crap.
I thought, you know, the Wright brothers would have recognized this.
Here's our motor bucket. We don't necessarily design for everyone else. We design for what we need. A recent goal we've been working on for a while is we want something that's better for mountains, something that's a little bit faster and maybe can fly a little longer because mountains are deceivingly large. They're going to go be a 2,000-foot cliff over there and we'll be up to the top, you know, in a matter of seconds without, you know, requires a lot of energy and different stuff. So we've been trying to perfect the mountain cruiser formula for a while.
I think usually that's the one that they're flying when they're just out practicing. They practice up in the Cache La Poudre Canyon, northwest of Fort Collins. It's a drive, a short drive from Fort Collins. Yeah, it's in the front range of the Rocky Mountains. And so they go up this road up into the canyon, and there are a lot of pullouts along the road.
So this is what we do. We pull off on the side of the road.
Great.
Jump out.
The first place we stopped, we were against a cliff wall, and the road is next to us, and then the river's on the other side. And it's you have the drone at your feet, and then the drone just goes and just goes right straight up out of sight. The pilot is wearing goggles, which are exclusively the feed from the camera on the drone. So you lose yourself in it.
So like Travis right now, he's just an empty carcass of a body standing there. And his consciousness is somewhere flying around this mountain.
You can set yourself challenges, like how close can you fly to the Cache La Poudre River? I mean, they're dodging rocks in the river, and it trains them, and it's good for reflexes, and it's good for a sense of, you know, the drone's capabilities and how close you can get to something and what you have to look out for.
Oh, the wind was knocking me around real good up there.
Yeah. You want to go for a ride?
Okay. They had brought along extra goggles so I could just watch the feed.
You might want to sit here.
You better to sit than to stand, you think?
Yes.
But I'm already feeling a little nervous about this.
And take the goggles off at any time you feel nauseous.
Okay. You don't think you're going to react, but it's impossible.
Okay, but I just saw that car go by, so...
Yes, you did. That car did go by.
Okay.
So it's not virtual reality. It is streaming reality... Right? You are just transplanted somewhere else.
Okay. Oh my gosh. Whoa. So I'm now right on top of that ridge that's on the other side, and I'm looking down on all these spires and things. Okay. Now I'm going along the river, and I went by that big spire that's sticking out there. And I go right down by that spire, and now I'm coming down the road. And I'm going over the river. Man, I'm going over the river. Okay. And this is the fastest I've ever gone over a river.
It's exhilarating, huh?
It's exhilarating. I mean, it just absolutely gets your entire body wired. It's just everything. Everything. I mean, you feel it in your toes and your knees and everything. Whoa, was that, did you just flip it over there?
Yeah.
Whoa. You feel like you're about to die. I found it necessary to hold on to the car tightly so that I did have some tactile grounding in actual physical reality. Whoa.
Well, you see yourself sitting there? Isn't that a bad sensation?
It is really strange. Yeah, it feels like you're flying. And you're
so engulfed in just being that drone.
Right. There's no feeling of your own self. It's mostly like what flying in a dream feels like. Mm-hmm. Only I've never had a dream in which I did a loop-de-loop or anything, you know, like spun around.
And we can't stop flying, so.
Yeah.
A lot of the people who fly are ex-adrenaline junkies. So like skateboarder, I'm a skier, Zach came from a motocross background. Mm-hmm. We know a lot of people from motorcycle, you know, they had a bad motorcycle accident. Mm-hmm. And this is their outlet to getting this sensation of I'm going 100 miles an hour an inch from the ground, and it's thrilling. Yeah. And yeah. Worst case, I crash and I'd break a $20 motor.
So if you meet somebody just at a party or on the street, and they ask you what you do, what do you say you do?
So that's actually this question that I've been struggling with myself.
I sort of chuckle and say I'm a professional drone racer because it doesn't seem like I should be able to say that or that it's real.
That's cool.
That's still something that's really hard for me to say to somebody. Like, for example, when I bought my car a month ago and I was looking for car insurance, right? They're like, what is your profession? And I went, well, I don't know. And one guy put down artist and one guy put down entertainer. Okay. And I said, all right, entertainer, because I'm on TV. You know, that works.
8 of the best from the whole year.
The best pilots in the world.
I'm here to win.
I can be the best, and that's why I'm here to prove it.
This is drone racing. This is DRL, the Drone Racing League.
Jordan and Zach are pilots who have contracts with a company called DRL, which stands for Drone Racing League, and it packages these races as programs that are shown on ESPN and on other sports networks in 75 countries, in fact.
Main event, Heat 7. A dude with a false start.
Jordan races under the name of Jet. Zach races under the name of A-Noob.
Duncan hit the gate, he's out.
The race courses are in places where there are opportunities for obstacles, for complicated courses. Miami Dolphins Stadium, for example, they've raced in an abandoned mall. And last year's finals were in Alexandra Palace in London.
Next is Palm Court and the Gravity Gate Ascent. Gab, really.
It isn't just a race on one plane. You have to go on this side of a gate. You have to go through that gate. You have to go over to that side of that obstacle. You then go up. And the one race that they had at the Alexandra Palace, there was a loop-de-loop going right straight up. And I think that the fact that Jordan and Zach spend so much time in the mountains made them particularly able to deal with that type of a course and help Jordan to win.
Jet finds another gear. He beats Gab in the U-turn.
No,
he takes it. Jet wins it all. Jet is your 2017 world champion.
I'm blown away, Greg. That may have been the greatest pass in drone racing history.
I've always wondered what happened to
giant checks.
Giant checks. You have a stack of giant checks.
Yeah, we got more on the walls.
He won a contract for the next year, and it's a, I guess, six-figure contract.
So he's broke. He's almost broke. And then I have some money. That's kind of the way it is right now.
But last year I did. It's really weird. You can either make money off prizes, which is almost no one does that, very few people. I was able to do that last year, which was really nice. This year, it's sort of DRL pays us for our time filming with them. Where's the money? There's not much right now. There's a little bit here and there, so you got to sort of fight for it and scrape by.
Zach and Jordan guess that there are probably about 50 pro drone racers in the world, but a lot of people are taking up the sport.
But, you know, now there's a bunch of 16-year-olds and 12-year-olds getting into it and starting to kick our butts around every now and then. But we're still pretty competitive.
I'm starting to fall behind a little bit because there are these guys who live in places like Indiana and all they do is race practice every single day. Mm-hmm. And they're getting incredibly fast and incredibly precise. And if I want to be competitive, I can't just be flippy floppying in the mountains all day long.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is a life that you get up, you talk about what you want to do, and you go out and do it. It has to be fun, and it has to be disciplined at the same time. And there's a great part of a poem by Robert Frost, and at the end of it, he's explaining how in his own life, he does not like to take the professional and the fun and separate them. He says, "But yield who will to their separation. My object in living is to unite my avocation with my vocation, as my two eyes are one in sight. Only where love and need are one, and the work is play for mortal stakes, is the deed ever really done for heaven and the future's sakes."
Staff writer Ian Frazier with a story from 2018. You can find everything Ian has written for us on a huge range of subjects at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick, and that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Peter Bresnan, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputabwele, with help from Allison McAdam, David Gable, Harrison Keithline, Alex Barish, Victor Guan, and Mengfei Chen.
Our Regina Spektor session was recorded by Louis Mitchell. We had assistance this week from Sarah Lilly, and special thanks to Dorit Strauss for the piano.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.